The following is brought to you by the Starfleet Podcast Network, SPN, The Spin.
That was the thing that amazed me, was how you were able to actually get performances out of the voices, because the voices weren't just, it sounds like DeForest Kelly saying these words, or it sounds like Leonard Nimoy saying these words. You could actually pick up that there was some acting behind it. This is Beyond Trek Podcast. I am Big J. I'm joined with Jonathan Lane, fan film factor blogger extraordinaire.
Extraordinaire.
So, yeah.
I'm extraordinaire.
I'll throw that in there. So Jonathan messaged me yesterday and said I would definitely want to talk with him in the next day. And then I saw the reason why, because he had a fan film that he released. And it was quite a piece of work. It was very interesting. So I don't want to take the thunder away from you. So Jonathan, why don't you go ahead and get us started? Tell us about this film you made.
You want me to do my own intro? Oh, geez. You know, on Fan Film Factor, you know, when I do an interview, or, you know, I introduce the fan film myself. I save my guests the extra hassle of having to explain it to people, but I'll do that for you. All right. Part of my service.
Thank you. Well, it's, I don't want to take away from what you may be, you know, talking about it. I know you did use AI for the voices. So this was the film with Spock and McCoy in it, which was amazing how you were able to get the voices in this story to be told. And it really sounded pretty authentic, which is...
It shocked the living daylights out of me.
It's scary that we're at that level of technology now.
You know, it started about a year ago, last May. My son Jaden was in a robotics world championships in Dallas. And to save money, we stayed with Mr. Ray Myers, who we all know, at least you do. He was one of my big donors for Interlude. And he has since gone on to become a very big player in fan films, works a lot with Josh Irwin on the Avalon Universe stuff, and just an all around awesome guy. And he and his family have a very large house in Plano, Texas, and he offered Jaden and me some sleeping space there, and a lot of fun was had by all. Ray is the CTO, Chief Technology Officer, of a tech company down there in Dallas. And a little before we were there last May, he was given a job by the board of directors to research AI. Yes, research AI. figure out what we can do with it.
Right.
As a company. Because like everybody wants to be involved in AI, but nobody really knows how yet. It's sort of like the internet was back in 1995. It's like, okay, well, we need a website. Is that what it's called? What do we do? So Ray found a number of things, but one of the things he found was 11 labs. And they have a website that contains an algorithm that if you type words into a text box, it will speak those words in any voice you want it to. You can have it generate its own voice based on whatever your parameters are: old man, young woman, little girl, Asian person, Latino, basically anything you want, it will do for you. Or you can upload your own voice samples to it, and it will recreate a synthesis of that voice, depending on the quality of the samples that you give it. And we were staying with Ray, and he showed us this. In fact, one of the first things he did was he had to do a version of Alec Peters' voice. apologizing for everything that's happened with Axanar. It was kind of funny. Anyway, we played with it for a bit. We had a speech by Joe Biden that my son wrote, where Biden was basically telling America that he got up in the middle of the night and he wet the bed, and then he had to go to the bathroom, and I'm not going to go there. We're
really
still voting for Biden, but yeah, it was absolutely hilarious. actually, maybe I'll send it to you and you can insert it there.
As long as that doesn't get us in trouble with the Democratic Party or any other political watchdog.
You know what? I voted for Biden last time. I'm going to vote for Biden this time. If they've got a problem with me being the one supplying the speech, you know, just deal with it.
Yeah.
But anyway, here it is, folks.
Hello, America. I would like to inform you that I woke up this morning and went to the bathroom, then went back to sleep because it was 1 a.m. I woke up again at 2 and went to pee again, then went back to sleep. I woke up again. I think it was 2:30. Actually, I think it was 2. No, it was 2:30. Anyway, I then took a shit and went back to sleep. I woke up again at 3 and found out that I had peed the bed. I then woke up at 4 and found out that I shit the bed. I think there might be something wrong with me.
that little stutter.
Okay, so that was our first experience with 11 Labs, and we were blown away by it.
Yeah.
And at the time, I hadn't even thought about doing the fan film with it, but when I got home, I was like, I wonder if I could do a Star Trek voice with it. And then I remembered that I had written this. It wasn't even a fan film. It wasn't even a short story, although I did win a short story contest with it. It was more of a script for a two-man stage play. It was McCoy and Spock. Kirk had just died. I died in air quotes because it was in Star Trek Generations.
Right.
And everybody thought he had died rescuing the Enterprise B. And I wrote this. It was just one of those things where, like, literally writing it out of my mind. I was just watching it happen and typing it in, you know, in almost a trance. It's like these were what the two men were saying to each other. McCoy was tortured by this. I mean, he always thought he would die before Kirk. You know, he's gotten drunk in a bar. He's trying to dull his pain. And in walks Spock. And Spock is the last person McCoy wants to see because, you know, McCoy is sad. He is miserable. He is as emotional as you can get. And the last thing you want to see is a person who doesn't seem to be affected by the death of his best friend. Mm-hmm. But in fact, that's exactly what McCoy needs. He needs the other point of the triangle. And he needs to see how somebody is dealing with it. And at the same point in time, Spock needs to see McCoy dealing with it emotionally, because Spock can't. He can't allow himself to do that. So it's this very beautiful, quiet dialogue that just, it goes on for about 15 minutes. And, you know, there are some very poignant moments. Most of them are McCoy's because, you know, he's the one who's feeling. Although there's a couple of moments where Spock kind of lets his guard down. And I also wrote it to cover some little Trekkie Easter eggs that I just decided would be kind of fun. Like, you know, for example, McCoy says at one point, Scotty doesn't believe he's really dead. And that was just my tip of the hat to the Star Trek The Next Generation episode Relics, where Scotty said, I knew Jim Kirk would rescue me.
I caught that. That was a nice nod.
Well, at that point, Scotty knows Jim Kirk's dead. Why would he think? And then another thing that I put in there at the very end was McCoy tells Spock, you need to loosen up. You need to have a sense of humor. You need to break some rules every so often and, you know, use a little cowboy diplomacy. And it was really, for me, it was like, it almost made sense that Spock's change in unification to being more of a rule breaker would come from McCoy. Because it would either come from Kirk or would it come from McCoy. And obviously it couldn't come from Kirk anymore, but if this was the last gift that Kirk gave Spock of saying, you know, this is how to be human. You break some rules. Not everything is logical. So I have this sitting on my hard drive, and I had always thought maybe I'll do something with this. You know, maybe, you know, when I finally got into fan films, I wrote this back in 2010 before I even started doing the blog. That was 2015, 2016. But when I finally got into fan films, I thought, you know, maybe I could do this as a fan film. It'd be very simple to film. Just, you know, we can even do it as a stage play. Just have, you know, two actors on stools in a black stage and just do it that way. But I sort of felt like there weren't good enough actors out there to do it who looked like McCoy or Spock. And I mean, like, I'd love to have Jens Dombeck, you know, the German Spock, do it, because he looks like Spock, but
right.
He's got the serious German accent, and I wasn't sure if that would work. And then there's a fellow named Frank Jenks, who's a cosplayer who looks so much like McCoy, but I didn't know if Frank could carry the emotion, the gravitas of it. So anyway, it just kind of sat and did nothing on my hard drive for, you know, 23 years, for 13 years.
Yeah.
And then when I came home from Dallas and I was thinking, what could I do with this 11 Labs thing? I thought, what if I try to make an audio drama of this stage play that I did? And so I started using 11 Labs. At first, I was using it at the base level of like $5 a month, and mm-hmm. they give you like, you know, 5,000 characters to do. And what I quickly discovered was that's way too little. just a few sentences from either one of them is like 100 or 200 or 300 characters. So,
right.
So anyway, I signed up for the biggest one, which was the $99 a month version. And I started playing with it. I sampled a bunch of different voice snippets from Spock and from McCoy, or more specifically from DeForest Kelly and Leonard Nimoy, because, you know, they do a lot of stuff. They've done convention appearances and interviews and various other things, as well as Star Trek. And I wanted to get as much of them older as I could. You know, they had to be the older characters. So as I started playing with it, what I discovered, much to my fascination and delight, is that 11 Labs, and very unlike other voice synthesizers, 11 Labs outputted speech could act. It would use the words that it was talking, that it was speaking, as cues of what to do with the tones and the emotion that was coming out.
That's scary.
And it was more than scary. I mean, it was mind blowing. Yeah. I mean, it was just, and, you know, sometimes it was wrong. You know, sometimes I couldn't get what I wanted from McCoy or Spock because the words that they were saying were different. Like, if McCoy was being sarcastic, how do I get that? You know, McCoy says, I wasn't exactly looking to, whatever it was, he says, when Spock says, you know, it was very difficult to find, you know, find you. And he's like, well, I wasn't exactly looking to publicize my whereabouts.
Yeah.
You know, but then I discovered that you could direct the actors by adding to what they say. So at the beginning of a speech where McCoy is being sarcastic, you simply say, I'm feeling very sarcastic now. Or, boy, am I angry, exclamation point. And if you do that, you can always chop that piece off. But what happens is, by giving the computer that prompt, the rest of it mostly follows whatever the beginning part of it is. But the only limitation that I discovered is that you really have to do it in little tiny chunks. Because if you gave it like, you know, a paragraph or, you know, like more than five sentences of stuff to do, sometimes it would start what I call drifting, where it would start going a little bit off the rails and a little bit more off the rails. And then suddenly McCoy is sounding like Gollum.
Right.
Yeah. It's got progressively worse. And, you know, if you're doing this in chunks of like 1,000 or 1,500 words each and it goes wrong, you're using up so much of your allotment for the month and just, you know, a wasted take. So yeah. Most of my takes were like, you know, maybe 100 to 400 words at the maximum. You know, I would just keep going until I got the take I wanted. Sometimes that took 5 or 10 tries. One time it took 112.
112 takes?
Uh-huh.
Wow. And this yeah. is...
You yeah, counted that? Up a lot of my money. Yeah.
Oh, man. Do you remember which line it was that took all that?
Oh, I don't know. I don't remember which one it was.
That would be something. Yeah. And that was the thing that really amazed me with the film, which, by the way, is called An Absent Friend, for anyone who didn't
Much better
read the title of. Yeah. What's that?
Much better than You're Dead, Jim.
Right, right. That would have been horrible. That was the thing that amazed me, was how you were able to actually get performances out of the voices, because the voices weren't just, it sounds like DeForest Kelly saying these words, or it sounds like Leonard Nimoy saying these words. You could actually pick up that there was some acting behind it. That was the part that really kind of threw me off, was because I was going into it, I was expecting just, you know, words being said in their voices, but there was actually inflection that was being done, and there was it was more of like an intelligent back and forth dialogue, which that really it kind of threw me for a loop. And it sounds like it wasn't easy to accomplish.
It was not easy, but you know, I am an obsessive perfectionist. Mm-hmm. As Josh Irwin will tell you, when we were editing Interlude, I drove him crazy. you know, I'll tell you a story. Back in design school, I graduated with a degree in psychology that I never use from Cornell, but then I went on to Pratt Manhattan for a 2-year associate's degree in design.
Yeah.
Graphic design. And that was 1990-91. And my typography teacher, and this is going somewhere, so just get comfortable. It's a good story. My typography teacher, Rose Wasserman, who was, you know, remember when the monks were hand lettering the Bible in the Middle Ages in the Bibles, and they were, you know, were basically making like one Bible per year and everything.
Like that. Yeah.
Well, Rose was standing behind them saying, "Watch your letter spacing." he was a little old at the time. And so 1990, 1991 was just the advent of desktop publishing, and computers were starting to be used to do professional graphic design layouts and, you know, page setups for printers and all sorts of stuff. But not a lot of older designers knew how to use the technology. And Rose was very much of the opinion that computers were evil. So she would take points away from us if we used the computer to do our typography homework.
Oh.
I took this as a challenge.
Really anti-technology.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I mean, she was actually a big advertising executive in New York during the 1950s. I mean, I know I said she was old, but I mean, you know, she made her career in the 50s and the 60s. And, you know, back in those days, you hand lettered everything, and mm-hmm. you know, you did not use computers to do it. And the reason that she didn't like computers was because she felt like the students would do something on, you know, the Macintosh or whatever, and they would use whatever desktop publishing or word processing program it was, and figure everything was perfect. You know, everything would be Helvetica.
Right. And,
you know, or Times Roman or whatever. You know, I think at the time I had like, you know, 25 or like 250 different fonts on my computer.
Anything but Comic Sans, right?
You know, or Papyrus. Anyway, what she wanted to teach us were things like kerning, where like if you have the letter L and the letter T next to each other, you have to kind of squeeze them together because they have all of this space between them. As Rose would say, I could drive a truck through that. So you needed to kern them and get them closer together to take out some of that negative space. Mm-hmm. Well, I would do that. And I would hand in homework assignments. And I would challenge Rose to tell me which ones I'd hand lettered and which ones I did with the computer.
So you like poking the bear.
I was an arrogant son of a bitch, but you know what? I was also one of Rose's best students, and she knew it and I knew it. And my goal, which I ended up achieving at the end of a full semester of having Rose for typography, or two semesters, was I got her to go from believing that computers were evil to believing that computers were a necessary evil. And I considered that to be a huge accomplishment because I didn't just let the computer make my decisions for me. I knew what I wanted. And when the computer didn't give me exactly what I wanted, I would fix it. Here we are, 35 years later, and I'm getting AI sound that was close to what I wanted, but not quite there. You know, sometimes Spock's voice would have a little hiss in it, you know, or there would be a little reverb, you know, from McCoy, because everything was different. You know, the thing about AI, if you've ever used it, is like it's always like you've never done this before. It always gives you a brand new something or other. So the thing was that I could use Adobe Audition, which is a sound editing program, to, you know, equalize the voices and get rid of the hums and the hisses and whatever else was wrong. I could make the volume more even. I could slow it down. I could speed it up. I could add pauses. You know, if I wanted McCoy to stop at some point with a little Captain Kirk pause or Captain Kirk pause, I could add that, or I could take it out. I could change the volume in the middle of something when he's yelling at the bartender. You know, I just basically raise the volume of that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I did a lot of extra work on it because, you know, I'm a freaking perfectionist. But it was just so amazing what I got, even in those initial takes. I mean, even if it took me 30 or 40 takes to get something, sometimes I was like, I know exactly what I want. And McCoy would give me a line reading. And when I say McCoy, I mean McCoy. I mean an algorithm.
The computer, yeah.
You know, would give me a line reading, and it goes, wow, that's pretty good. I hadn't even thought about doing it that way. That's not bad. And I would save that file. You know, usually I would like end up with like four or five different potential ones that I would use. Sometimes I'd mix and match. I could cut this and put this with this. And sometimes I couldn't because they didn't really match. But, you know, it was a lot of work. I mean, it was probably about 200 hours over the course of 2 months to get the audio done.
Yeah. And so the animation, did you do that also? How was the animation done? Who did that part of it?
Perfect. Next question. When I had the final audio drama, which mm-hmm. was, like I said, about 15 minutes long, the only problem that I had, and it was a little bit frustrating, was that because I had taken this in little snippets, you know, one or two or three sentences at a time, especially for McCoy, who had longer, uninterrupted, you know, bits of dialogue, things wouldn't match. Like the first three sentences would sound like this, and then the next three sentences would still sound like McCoy, but just maybe a little lower,
mm-hmm.
or a little fuller, or a little raspier, or whatever. I mean, we wouldn't be a complete and total. I mean, I tried to get it to match as much as possible. I tried to get McCoy to sound like McCoy, because sometimes, you know, it wouldn't sound like McCoy. Sometimes it would sound British. A couple of times it sounded like a female. I mean, it was like whatever the AI thought it was doing, I don't know what it was. But, you know, sometimes McCoy was completely out of left field. It's like, that's not even close to McCoy. It's not even right. close. But even just, you know, the ones that did sound like DeForest Kelley, didn't quite match. And what I thought to myself is, if I could turn this into a visual, I can change the image when that tonal quality or that cadence changes. So if McCoy's talking, if we go from this shot of McCoy to this shot of McCoy to this close-up of McCoy or whatever, every time it changes, maybe the ear will be more forgiving if the eye sees something different. And I thought, okay, well, then let's do that. I had no idea how. And first I thought, you know, maybe I'll just use some stills from Star Trek, do a little photoshopping. Obviously, you've got McCoy in the bar in Star Trek III.
Right.
You don't really have Spock in the bar, but maybe I could just, you know, take some shots of Spock and, you know, get other background of bars or whatever, and just, you know, a lot of photoshopping. But it was a lot of work, and I sort of felt like I didn't really have, and McCoy looks too young in Star Trek III when he's in his civilian clothes. Yep. Even in Star Trek IV, I needed him looking like he looked in Star Trek VI, but in Star Trek VI, he spends the entire time in his, you know, Master Maroon uniform. So,
right.
So strike one. And then I thought, well, I'm using AI to do the voices. Why don't I use AI to just generate Dr. McCoy in a bar? You know, let's see that. And AI is not smart enough to do that yet. If you say Dr. McCoy from Star Trek, even if you say from Star Trek, the movies, or Star Trek in a Monster Maroon uniform or in a Starfleet uniform from 92 93, or, you know, or in civilian clothes or whatever, it gives you Dr. McCoy from TOS.
Okay. So it's going to do TOS no matter how you try to word it and get it.
Exactly. With a six fingered hand, by the way, it hasn't quite figured out yet. and it's like the uniform is always like weird. Also, it's like, doesn't quite match because it's AI or whatever. And the bar is always different. So, you know, you might have different angles or whatever, but for the most part, the angle is almost always forward or three quarter. The bar is always different, and it just strike two. It didn't work that way. And so, interestingly enough, I guess it was last September or so when the very short treks that CBS produced, which were animated style, but modern Star Trek shorts of about 3 or 4 minutes each, were released on YouTube. And they brought back the old Filmation quality animation. And I saw this and I was like, that's it. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make TAS, the animated series, I'm going to make TAS in the movie era.
Nice.
And then I was like, but how? Because I can't draw. I went to design school. I didn't go to illustration school. I'm not an illustrator. I'm a designer. I deal with concepts, not details. I often like to say the difference between an illustrator and a designer is like the difference between a fireman and a police officer. They both drive around in vehicles with sirens on them, and they help people, and they wear uniforms, and they use tools, but they do completely different things.
Right.
And I can't draw to save my life.
Me neither. I am a horrible drawer.
So, which is not to say I can't fix a drawing. You know, if somebody does it first, I can make little changes to it, but I can't do it from scratch. And about the same time, pardon me, Vance Major came out with a Constar comic book. And it was just like a few pages or whatever, but I thought, you know, this is pretty cool. I'd like to interview his artist. You know, I've interviewed Vance about a million times. So let's interview the artist, find out, you know, what he's all about. Yeah. And I contacted him. His name is Matt Slade. He lives in Louisiana. And as I was chatting with him, I thought to myself, maybe he might be interested in helping me to animate, draw this fan film. Told him about the project. I shared the audio file with him. I said, you know, would you be able to draw in, you know, TAS style? And he said, well, I mean, because keep in mind the guidelines say you can't pay anybody. So, you know, he's trying to say yes without, you know, committing to too much work.
Right.
And he said, you know, if I could have something to trace over, I could do this. Obviously, he'd have to, you know, make a civilian clothes for McCoy, and he, you know, change Spock into a uniform or whatever. He'd add wrinkles to the face, but at least he'd be basing it on stuff that had already been done. So thus began another month of work for me as I went through. If you go to trekcore.com, T-R-E-K-C-O-R-E, you will discover screen caps, literally like tens of thousands of them, yeah, from all of the various Star Trek television series, you know, from TOS to TNG, DS9, Voyager, and of course the animated series. And so what I did was I went through every one of the 22 episodes of the animated series. I basically screen capped or copied their screen caps of anything with Spock or McCoy in it. And I put them into layered Photoshop documents, some of them with like 100 different layers. And then I went through and chose what I consider to be good shots of McCoy and good shots of Spock. You know, some of them, you know, three quarter, some of them close up, you know, some of them sideways, and just concatenating them together. I put together a storyboard, mm-hmm, and the storyboard looks really, really weird. it's up on my Google Drive for anybody who wants to see it, but it is, it's just really, really weird because you just see this static TAS, you know, Spock in his old blue tunic, McCoy in his old blue tunic, and they're not moving, they're not animated or anything, but this was just, I laid it out in storyboard format with the audio running underneath it for the whole thing. And I had like maybe 10 or 12 different shots for each character. So maybe 24, 25 in total. So that's not too much for the illustrator to do, with the understanding that, you know, he would do different lip positions for each one as well, which is, by the way, still a heck of a lot of work.
moving lips.
Well, you know,
I would imagine.
We ultimately discovered, thanks to a YouTube video, because everything is on YouTube, that in order to make realistic lip movements, you only need 9 cells.
9? That's it? 9.
Mm-hmm. Closed. You need an O.
Uh-huh.
You need a W, R, or U. So O, U. Close. O is bigger. U is left. S and sk and sh and ch and z all do the same thing.
Uh-huh.
A and e. Same thing. E, N. So e, E, N. Basically like the A and the E, but a little bit more closed. And L have the tongue coming out. So TH, L, F, L.
Right.
You put all this together and you basically can put everything, every consonant and every vowel sound that you need into 9 different lip movements.
Wow.
Amazing.
Now, see, it would have been cool if you went the Thunderbirds route. Was it Thunderbirds? The mouth was like a real person's mouth talking, but it was dolls or the animation. What was that?
I don't think that was Thunderbirds.
You know, no.
But, you know, but they did do that, you know, like in the,
you know what I'm talking about though, right? Yeah,
the Bass animations, you know, when they used to do, you know, the Santa Claus stuff, you know, the Christmas stuff, they would have the marionettes. And then what they would do is they would just draw over the cells, the movements of the mouth. So, you know, you could do that as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, with TAS, it's what they did. And the thing about TAS, thank God they did this, is the faces were all symmetrical. So like Spock's hair is obviously easy, but so was McCoy's. You know, I have my part on this side here, this side.
Right.
You know, for McCoy, his part was sort of the same on both sides. It just came down the middle. So I could easily flip McCoy and flip Spock. Because I wanted McCoy to always be, you know, pointed in this direction.
Yeah.
And I wanted Spock to always be pointed in this direction. So if I had like the perfect pose for one of them and they were pointing in the wrong direction, just flip it. So Matt began to make the drawings, and then I did the animation because the animation was so meticulous. So based on every lip movement, I would go through the timeline, and I would just bring out each lip movement that I needed when that syllable, that consonant, that phoneme, whatever it was. I mean, like the word Spock, which is one syllable, starts out with S, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it has a P. So it goes from the S to the P to the A to the K, which is the same as the S. So Spock has four different cells in it.
Okay. Okay.
You know, Enterprise. Enter, the T, so that's two. R is the R-O-W little thing. So Enterprise. P. R. So R is, once again, that little O-U. I is I and A and I. So I. And then S. So Enterprise is seven different cells. You don't even get me started on the word appropriate. Oh my
God.
Yeah. But anyway, that's how I did it for months and months and months at a time. And, you know, he would keep feeding me like new cells or whatever. And I would like take a weekend and put those in, show him how it look. And, but it was fun because, you know, I'd be doing this. I'd be like, you know, for like 5 or 10 minutes, I would be just like staring and like moving this and moving that and whatever. And, you know, I would get like a sentence or two done and I was like, I need to take a brain break. And so I would go and I would just like, okay, let's see what this looks like. And I would play it out and I would see McCoy's lips moving, you know, to the words, like, holy crap, that does look like he's saying those words. It's magical. It's like,
wow,
all that work I've just been doing for the last 10 minutes, it really works.
Yeah.
And when it doesn't work, you know it. You know, like the eye and the brain are very forgiving if it doesn't look perfect.
Right.
You know, as far as the lips moving or whatever. But if something's off, if something's like, if the T comes in a little early, or, you know, you're still seeing the E when the E should have faded into a closed mouth position or whatever, you do notice that. And so there's a lot of little, you know, moving it like by literally like one frame, moving that from one frame. And it was just.
That sounds tedious, which I know that there's certainly a lot of work that I do in video editing and audio. And you're right. You can kind of get to where you're knuckle dragging because you're just adjusting that one little thing. You spend more time on it than you should or that you needed to, but it's like, okay, I want this to be perfect. I don't know why, but I'm going to sit here until that's done. And it's the kind of thing that nobody's going to notice. You know, you're going to know it because you did it, but you know, it's one of those things. It's kind of like, okay, well, it's for my peace of mind. I made it exactly the way I wanted it to be, whether anyone notices that or not.
Well, I'll tell you, my perfectionism probably drove Matt a little crazy because, like, for example, Spock's uniform, I wanted him in the bomber jacket. That's my favorite Star Trek uniform of all time.
Mm-hmm.
But like, you know, for example, you know, the arm braid, you know, where, you know, he's got all the little, you know, pips and squeaks, yeah, and whatever on it. I had to draw all those on. I mean, he would start it up and like put little things on there. And I would like, you know, I'd go in and I would like meticulously adjust them pixel by pixel to make sure, you know, the long ones were there and then the short tips were there. And, you know, the number of times I made him redo the captain's rank pin. I don't even want to count. But there were a lot of times where I just said, you know, look, Matt, you're working so hard. Let me fix this.
Right.
You know, and some artists were like, no, I'll fix it. You know, don't touch it or whatever. Like, you know, Matt was fine. He was like, you sure you want to do some of the work? I'm happy to have that. So, so we really did work collaboratively on a lot of stuff. And, you know, like if Sulu wasn't looking just right, or Chekhov wasn't looking just right in one of those little flashback things, you know, he would say, like, I can't seem to get it. And I would go in and I would just, you know, I would redo some of the wrinkles, or, you know, move a nose or a nostril or whatever that I can do. And then he would just draw over what I would give him back. And then one of the things that we did, by the way, and, you know, we discussed this together, and he was very nice to do this and add this to all the other drawings that he was doing, is there were a number of places where I added little flourishes to break up the monotony, because otherwise it's just Spock talking, McCoy talking, Spock talking, McCoy talking, back and forth. It could get very boring visually.
Right.
So what I would do is I would add in little, I could call them flourishes, flashbacks or whatever. So, you know, if they're talking about Scotty and Chekhov, we show a shot from Star Trek Generations where the two of them are, you know, standing there in engineering looking out the hole, in the hole. And, you know, we're talking about Sulu. We see Sulu. We see D'Amoro, and Spock says, you know, D'Amoro is the chief helm officer of the Enterprise. So, you know, he also did some really, really nice recreations of some TOS episodes, including the Tholian Web, Human Kirk in a spacesuit, and two shots from Shore Leave, and a great shot of Chekhov getting shot from Spectre of the Gun, and Nomad from the Changeling. And if you go and look at the picture of Nomad, he did a great Nomad. But those little radiator grill holes on Nomad, he didn't bother doing, because that was just like, you know, who the hell cares about that? You know,
right.
I am working for peanuts, literally. So yeah. let's I wasn't even getting peanuts, but anyway, so I went in and I created those little grill holes for him, for Nomad. So it was very collaborative, and yeah, you know, he was great to work with. He was one of the best experiences I've ever had with an illustrator in my entire life.
That was one of the things that I also really, really appreciated, because this is something that I did. I've been making a lot of these behind the scenes videos for Alec Peters and for Axanar. And I've, you know, in the different video editing that I've done, and this was something that I even carried over from, I was a sports producer for a news station in Columbus at one point when I was in college. And what I would do is edit the sports highlights. So for example, if you watch the news and they get to the sports part of it, whenever you see the clips from the game, like, that was what I would do, is edit that. And whenever we would have something that would be an interview, you know, showing an interview that an athlete did, what I was taught was, if the person is talking about this or this thing or this play, do whatever you can to show what they're talking about. So when you do these things, like, for example, when I was doing the behind the scenes video, if whoever was talking during the interview, when I was playing the, you know, them speaking, if they start talking about, like, the instrument panels or the view screen or the whatever, you show what they're talking about. Instead of sitting there looking at them speaking for 5 minutes straight, you cut that in with pictures or videos of what they're talking about. And when you did that, that was a very, very welcome addition, because Spock or McCoy, they're talking about a thing and you actually show what it is they're talking about. And that really helps with the immersion of it. And you're right. If anything, that helps to break up the Spock, McCoy, Spock, McCoy, Spock, McCoy, the back and forth. You get to where you can see something different. And storytelling wise, that was a great way to tell a story, was to add that visual to show the animation of this is what they're talking about. So I definitely give you big thumbs up for that. So this is another topic that I wanted to talk about, because the fan film guideline watchdogs are losing their shit over the entire thing. I mean,
want me to get sued.
Their heads are spinning in circles. Like,
I mean, Nadav, whatever his last name is, basically just tried to, you know, lay out Paramount's legal argument. You know, if you want to sue Jonathan, this is how you do it. But he says, you know, not trying to be a, you know, a doomsayer or anything. And then he proceeds to lay out the case.
Yeah, I read that. Like, yeah, not to be an ass, but I'm about to be an ass.
Exactly. And I'm like, you know what? Here's the thing. You know, one of my very, very good friends, one of my oldest friends, we've known each other since high school, is a lawyer out here in Los Angeles. And he's worked in the entertainment industry for, I think, 30 years. The first thing he told me was, you know, first of all, Jonathan, it's just a fan film, for God's sakes. And he said, the other thing is,
you should have said to him, okay, hold my beer. Let me explain this to you.
Well, you know, I mean, the thing is that it is just a fan film.
Right.
But the other thing is that the first thing he said to me is, he said, look, if you were to get somebody to imitate Spock or imitate McCoy, I mean, you know, like to hire an actor to do an imitation, would that be illegal? No.
Hmm. Okay.
Well, what you're doing is you're getting a computer to imitate Spock and McCoy. It's not an exact.
Right.
Replication. I mean, you can tell it's not McCoy and you can tell it's not Spock. I mean, it's close. It's great. But there's some times where, you know, they're definitely not there.
Right. We know it's an imitation.
You know, it's definitely an imitation. You're not sourcing anything directly. And what he told me is that it's not what you put into it, but what you get out of it. Is it transformative? And so it doesn't matter what you're sourcing. If you're sourcing Star Trek episodes or movies, or if you're sourcing interviews, you're sourcing convention appearances or whatever. The thing is the algorithm is putting that together in an amalgamation. And one of the things I told Nadav was, you know, there's a song called, I know what you what you're thinking. Is there something that's on your mind? But anyway, Spock is pure energy.
Yeah,
it's from the 80s, and the pure energy is a sample of a Star Trek episode. It's from Errand of Mercy, and it's definitely Spock taken directly from that episode. So their output, even though they're putting music underneath it, is a copy. What I'm doing is not a copy. If McCoy says that green-blooded son of a bitch, it's his revenge for all those arguments he lost. McCoy's not saying that. And if McCoy is saying the word "the," or if he's saying, you know, green-blooded, which, you know, he does say green-blooded. You know, if you go to my thing, at one point he calls Spock a green-blooded hobgoblin.
Yeah.
But if you listen to that green-blooded, it's not the same green blood. As was in Star Trek 3. I don't even know if I sourced Star Trek 3. I'm not even sure. That might be too young for McCoy. But anyway, even if it were, it's not the same. It's transformed. It's not that exact sound sim. But, you know, the main thing is that even for a copyright infringement claim, mm-hmm. it's non-willful infringement only because the laws are so vague on all of this. And the fine for a non-willful infringement is $750. So, you know, I can afford that. And the other thing is that you have to go through tens of thousands of dollars in suing somebody. Yes. In order to get that $750. You know, even if they get $10,000 or $11,000 or whatever. They're spending three or four or five times that. So no, they don't want to go after a small fish like me. And of course, you know, going after a fan for making a fan film is bad PR, especially when you're trying to sell your company to Skydance. And Skydance has come in, and I don't think the first thing Skydance wants to do is start alienating the Star Trek fans. So this is out there. You know, as for permission from the actors, I mean, that was, somebody said, you're taking away work from hardworking actors. Like, well, I'm taking away free work from hardworking actors because I can't pay anybody. But I'm certainly not taking away work from Leonard or Tavares Kelly. They're dead. They can't do the work. I'm sorry. And you know, I did actually ask Adam Nimoy for permission on this. Adam wasn't able to do that because it's something that the estate would give. But he did wish me luck with the voiceover with the project.
Now, did Adam get you in touch with the estate?
Yeah, well, I got in touch with the law firm that handles the estate.
Oh, okay. All right.
I talked to the legal assistant of the lawyer specifically that does that. And he was very, very nice. He was excited by the project. He says, it sounds great. And, you know, a week later, he said, you know, unfortunately, we can't give you permission, but at the same point in time, we're not telling you can't do it. The issue is that in order to give me permission, they have to research the law on it. They have to write up some kind of contract or whatever. I mean, if they're licensing it, whether they're just giving me permission or whatever, any minute that they spend on this is billable. And the estate has to pay for that. And, you know, lawyers charge $500 to $1,000 an hour. So
it, oh, yeah, they're crooks.
My wife's a lawyer.
Oh, sorry. Except for your wife.
And by the way, she does not make the $1,000 an hour or whatever she bills at. You know, she gets a mere pittance of that.
Yeah.
But they have a very nice office there. Their offices are gorgeous. Oh my God. But they're lawyers in Los Angeles and they're entertainment lawyers. So that's even better because you have to really look good.
Yeah.
But the fact is that, you know, the estate, they don't have that kind of money and they don't have that kind of time to spend. So, you know, very much like CBS and Paramount have a don't ask, don't tell relationship with fan films. You know, they don't give us permission. None of us get official permission to do this. The guidelines are not permission. The guidelines are just, if you do these things, we're not going to sue you. It's different than giving you permission.
Right.
But in the same way, you know, the Nimoy estate doesn't want to have to spend all this money trying to figure out how to give some random Trekkie in Los Angeles, you know, permission to do something he's probably going to do anyway. And even if they did want to sue me for this eventually down the line, once again, $750, I looked it up. I'm willing to license it for $750. So, you know, whatever. You know, that's it. And honestly, even then, you know, they had to prove anything. The law in California, and California is definitely the prevailing law on this because Leonard Nimoy and DeForest Kelly both lived and died in California, and I live in California. Mm-hmm. And California law has an exemption specifically for using the likeness of voice or appearance or whatever of a dead person. There's an exemption for a play, for a book, for a photograph, for a film, you know, and a number of other things. And basically, the only thing you can't do is put them into a commercial. But everything else, you're good for. So even that $750, if they wanted to go and spend tens of thousands of dollars suing me, is not something they're going to be able to get because the law, at least at this moment, exempts me, which is great, which is why I released now. There are pieces of legislation working their way through the California State Assembly, through the U.S. Congress, and another one working through the U.S. Senate to deal with AI, but they have not dealt with it yet. So they're still trying to figure this out. And even once they pass the legislation, some of the legislation may step on fair use rules.
Right.
and First Amendment rights and such. So, you know, they could get challenged in court. So,
and that's more money and more time.
Well, it's more money, more time for somebody else at that point, because if you want to, you know, if you want to challenge it in court and saying this law is, you know, unconstitutional or whatever, because it violates First Amendment rights, you know, that would be something for somebody who got sued after the law passed to do. But the thing is that AI legislation, while it's coming, is not coming particularly soon. You know, Congress can't agree on anything right now, so I don't expect anything to be coming out of the House.
Except for banning TikTok.
Except for banning TikTok. There you go. And naming post offices, they do that rather.
Right? Oh, yeah.
So, you know, we're still a few years away from really early AI legislation being established. And even that, I think, is, you know, not going to be the final format of whatever the legislation is. But, you know, at this point, here I am releasing a fan film saying, this is an example of what you can do when, you know, it's not revenge porn, or you're not trying to, you know, fake a political ad or a robocall or something from a candidate or whatever. You're not trying to do harm. You're just trying to honor somebody in a creative way. And who knows, maybe the assembly or the legislature or the Congress or whatever might even use this as this fan film as a way to say, okay, you know, the law should be written in this kind of a way. Or maybe they won't know about it at all. I have no idea. It's only had 400 or 500 views in the first day and a half. So
wouldn't that be something if you were part of the legislation, the creation of this, we would either, look at that as a good thing or a bad thing, of course, but I would imagine that would be a pretty interesting position to be in, would be to have that, to have this film, An Absent Friend, be an example of, this is where the technology is. This is what it's capable of. And this is how it's going to be used. So if we're going to keep expanding technologically with AI and all of these other things, we need to prepare for that. What are we going to do when someone creates that artificial intelligence, that person? Do we need to rewatch Measure of a Man now to be ready for that? Because it's going to happen. We're going to get to that point. And of course, right now we're very reactionary. We're not proactive about anything. We're going to react to when somebody comes up with a thing and then see, okay, well, here's this thing. Now, how do we legislate it? I don't know.
But that's always been an issue in this country. You know, from anti-slavery laws and you know, the laws after the Civil War and civil rights legislation and the New Deal policies under FDR. I mean, we were reacting to issues that presented themselves, you know, as we grew as a country. You know, before there was television, we didn't have any need for, you know, broadcast standards, you know,
right.
And now, you know, and then the whole net neutrality, you know, who knew the net neutrality was going to be a thing back in 1980? But, you know, now we have the internet and it needs to be established that, you know, people should all be able to get the same bandwidth, regardless of whether they're dealing, you know, with a provider that's paying more for a sweetheart deal or not. I think it's a good thing that AI is making us take a harder look at what's going on. It's one of the reasons that I made this fan film. Part of it was, I wanted to turn my script into a fan film, but honestly, I could have turned my script into a fan film at any point during the last, you know, dozen years. I never did. But now that AI is becoming such a part of our lives, and, you know, just seeing what this 11 Labs thing could do, this gave me a perfect opportunity to explore this, and not only to explore it, but to blog about it. And so, you know, with all of this said, it's fascinating. It's terrifying in some cases. It's exciting. It's exhilarating. There's so many emotions. I mean, we live in interesting times.
Yeah, we do.
You know, so, you know, yeah. So now I've got my AI fan film out there. I got it out of my system. I'm not going to do another one of these, folks. You know, I've gotten all these comments on YouTube. People love it. They want to see more and more and more. It's like, I'm sorry, but this was a year of my life.
That's a year of my life I'm not going to get back, but that's,
and it was a fun year of my life. Yeah. I enjoyed doing it. It was great on a, it was great to get new animation cells and be able to, like, a, because, you know, this wasn't done from beginning to end. You know, this was done in pieces. Yeah. So, like, if I got, like, a new Spock or whatever, you know, that Spock appeared, you know, at the 12-minute mark and at the 4-minute mark and at the, you know, 9-minute and 50-second mark or whatever. And so I would just, like, suddenly, like, I was so excited. Let's just get some Spock in there. You just, you're watching the whole thing. It's like, you know, the still image. Oh, here's the moving mouth and the still image. Oh, here's the moving mouth. And, you know, here's the shot of the Enterprise in the middle of the Nexus. And it was exciting to see it all take shape.
Well, I think you did a very good job on it. And I know I, for one, appreciate all the work that you put into doing this film and being a part of a community that likes to create and put out content and to have something positive to say about that content. Hopefully, at some point down the line, you'll wake up and say, you know what, I am going to do another thing, whether it's live action or animation or whatnot. I think that'd be great if you did that.
Another fan film written. We'll see what happens
with it. Yeah.
It's a musical.
Oh, okay.
And by the way, I had this musical before Strange New Worlds ever did a musical. And it's my musical, they don't ask why they're singing. It's just, you know, it just happens to be a musical. But it'll be fun. And the fun part about the musical is all the songs that are in it, and they're all parody songs, of course. Mm-hmm. But all the songs that are in it are songs that would have been playing on the radio while William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy and DeForest Kelly were driving to Paramount in the 1960s to film Star Trek.
Oh,
they're all like 50s and 60s songs. There's one song from like 1971 that I had to have in there. Like, I know Star Trek wasn't on in 71. They weren't driving Paramount, but it's there anyway. But all the rest of them are those classic tunes that people of my generation know, and the younger kids these days have no appreciation for.
Right. Jonathan, where can our audience find you online, social media sites, blogs? Tell our fans, where can we find more Jonathan Lane?
Fanfilmfactor.com.
Fanfilmfactor.com.
Fanfilmfactor.com. That is a, I think I even got the com. Yeah, there it is. There
we go.
.com is not up there, but anyway, yeah, Fan Film Factor is the best place to find me. Also, Fan Film Forum, because everything has to have three F's with me. But Fan Film Forum on Facebook. There is a Patreon that I have, but and you can find it if you go to Fan Film Factor. If you want to give me some money on a monthly basis, because I have costs just to do the website and keep security and everything. Firewalls and such, and hosting. Let's see. Am I on X, Twitter? Probably still somewhere. I don't know. I think stuff automatically gets posted there, but I hardly ever check that. But really, you know, Fan Film Forum on Facebook is a good place to get in touch with me. And of course, Jonathan@fanfilmfactor.com. If you wanted to email me and say something nice, and you can leave a comment on the video. An Absent Friend. If you look on YouTube, you'll find it. So I think that pretty much covers it.
Jonathan, thank you so much for speaking with me this evening. Really like the film. Appreciate it. Thank you for all of your work. And for our audience that is listening and or watching, live long and prosper.
And by the way, thank you for interviewing me, because it saves me from having to interview myself.
That would be a good project. Have you side by side interviewing yourself, just changing face this way, then face that way.
Yeah.
If you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us at patreon.com/beyondtrek.
We are Beyond Trek Podcast. Lower your inhibitions and surrender your years. We will add inspirational and hilarious Trek content to your day. Your attention will adapt to subscribe to us. Resistance is futile.